that are most complicated and most demanding. Because Pesach is something for which we kosher, not from what's not kosher. After all of our homes are kosher, 365 days a year. So because it's something that's kosher, chametz can be purged in a more lenient fashion than if it were burnt into something that's not kosher. Well, you know, your examples might be accidents that might happen with a pot being used with fire, with frying, maybe a fleshing a pan and cheese ingredients, where we're talking now real basar b'chalav with fire being applied to the pan, and you have to use fire, nothing less than fire, to kasher that pan. You have to take a torch to it, as an example. Here, because what we have used during the year is all product that's kasher, these chametz products that we've baked and that we've cooked are all kasher. And it is at the point in time before Pesach that we are kashering. We're kashering the oven at a point in time when what we are removing, the flavor being removed, is still something kasher. It's not Pesach yet. It's before Pesach. So one can therefore rely upon what's called libun kal, as opposed to having to make the sides of your oven glow from heat. You don't have to take a torch to the oven because we're kashering in a manner in which just a lot of heat, more than is typically used in the cooking process, will suffice to purge that oven. Therefore, since nobody ever cooks with 700-800 degrees, a self-cleaning oven is certainly sufficient. But even if we don't have a self-clean oven, even if we have an old-fashioned oven or the self-cleaning somehow isn't working properly, we can kosher an oven for Pesach by making sure it's spotless, making sure it's very clean, and then waiting 24 hours before we do libun kal, which will involve really just turning on the oven to its highest setting, 450, leaving it that way for 3 hours, with a pan of water, an aluminum pan of water as an example, just so that there's moisture in the oven, because all year when you use it with chametz, there's moisture in the oven, so you should do likewise when koshering it. You should have moisture fill the air of that hot oven when you're koshering it. Of course, the racks can be koshered the same way. They can be koshered at the same time. They're in the oven at this point, cleaned and also not used for 24 hours. And the oven is kosher. As long as it's spotlessly clean. Now, the problem is, what if you clean your oven and you think it's perfectly clean, you kosher it, and I don't mean with self-clean, I mean you kosher it with this method of keeping something in there with some water and then using the highest setting, keeping it that way for 3 hours, and then you find something that was not yet burnt up, not clean, a nook, a cranny, something that you suspect was real chametz that was now in the oven and you haven't really gotten rid of it. And it's now on your mind and you feel, well, what am I going to do? So according to most poskim, you would have to scrub that off, remove that, what we call mamashas, because you can't kasher correctly if there is mamashos in the oven, and start the process again. that's how careful we have to be to make sure that the light bulb, the screen that covers the light bulb, as an example, has no chametz that somehow adhered to it, that's stuck to it. That's how careful we have to be to make sure that the gasket around the door of the oven and the hinges where the oven opens and closes all are very, 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 very clean of any actual, you know, visible residue of any food.
You have, the door of the oven has glass, and there's always a hollow between the two pieces of glass, and really the only way to get at it is take the door apart.
Not necessary.
That's...
The glass constitutes a wall. If, because of spillage at some point in time, somehow there's something not fully clean between the panes of glass, as long as the heat you've used in the koshering process is greater and longer lasting than that with which the oven is typically used, you can use it for Pesach, even though you will still see some discoloration between the panes of glass of the door. After you've done this, it is not necessary to cover the gaskets. The gasket does not comprise an inner part of the oven. The gasket is not exposed to the air of the oven. If it is exposed to the air of the oven, then the heat that you use to kosher the oven is sufficient to dry out any food that's left or adhering to the gasket, as long as you've cleaned it. If you've cleaned the gasket and all that's left is some, you know, nebulous, tasteless, negative flavor perhaps that's sunk into the dirty gasket, then you can't get that out. But it's exposed to 450 degrees for 3 hours, it too should be considered kosher. So you do not have to cover the gasket or the rim of the door of your oven. It's not necessary.
I thought if you do
libun,
you didn't have to wait 24 hours.
That's if you do full libun. Then if you do a cleaning cycle,
self-cleaning,
you do not have to wait 24 hours because you're doing real libun. You're using what's comparable to actual flame.
Self-cleaning oven, you do not need to wait 24 hours.
No.
What's libun?
That's when you burn something out using fire, making it glow, because it's so hot. But you don't have to do that if you don't have a clean cycle, a self-clean cycle in your oven. If you have just a plain good old-fashioned oven without self-cleaning, you can kosher it the way we just said.
That's how you would kosher it, but...
You would kosher it with... If you have a self-clean, then you could literally use it, you know, for, you know, chametz, and then, you know, run a clean cycle, running a self-clean cycle, burns it out
right after that,
oh, and I'll use it, and I'll cook for Pesach.
So you don't have to wait 24 hours with a self-clean
oven. Correct.
Is there a minimum number of hours for self-clean?
Just as long as you know that it reaches, you know, the temperature that the company says cleans it. Usually it's about 2 hours.
Absolutely.
Usually it's about 2 hours, and what you find very often, if it wasn't perfectly clean to begin with, you will find an actual slight layer of ash on the bottom of the oven. That's the extent to which it's like a real libun. Everything that's left in there, any of the, you know, bit of fat or grease or whatever that's spilled, actually turns to that much ash. Now, there are other types of ovens that are a bit more complicated. There are convection ovens that have a combination of forced hot air and or microwave cooking. And because that is an oven in which you do not only microwave, if it's not self-clean, you will have to do this method. You'll have to turn it on with the air blowing on the highest setting, with the racks and the sides and the wall, everything having been cleaned and left for 24 hours, you'll do exactly what you would do for a gas or an electric oven that does not have self-cleaning. If it's a convection oven and not a classic microwave, you have to make sure to use the convection mode to clean it, as opposed to just saying, well, I'll clean it like I would clean a microwave, because I can clean a microwave oven for Pesach, and you can, but not if it's convection. If it's a convection oven, then it's actually using forced hot air and microwave cooking, so that has to be kosher the way you would kosher an oven that does not have a self-clean cycle.
If your regular oven has convection mode in the regular oven, when you do the self-cleaning, does that cover that you could use convection?
You should. If you have a regular oven, not microwave, but a regular oven that has the typical setting plus convection,
correct,
you should run it with the convection, because there are areas where air passes in and out that also need to be covered. So you should definitely run it with the convection aspect of it, with the air being forced in and out while you're kosher.
What about if it's self-clean?
Not if it's self-clean.
Then you don't worry about it.
If you're self-clean, you don't have to worry about it.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Microwave ovens, while some are of the opinion that they really can't be kosher, the truth is, if you clean it really, really thoroughly, then it can be kosher. But thoroughly means that you take a toothpick and or a toothbrush to the gasket that separates the wall of the oven from the ceiling of the oven and from the floor of the oven. There's a small little rubber or plastic gasket. It tends to collect the residue of food and spillage. And it contains, therefore, Chametz gum. That has to be cleaned very, very thoroughly. There's also a screen through which light and air pass. That screen is usually on the walls of your microwave on one side, and that also tends to collect residue of food, and that also has to be cleaned out using toothpick, using a toothbrush, and really going at it with some cleanser, Fantastic, Comet, something of that nature. And again, the door and the plastic glass or whatever the door is made of has to be very thoroughly cleaned. The hinges, where the hinge of the door allows you to open and close it, all of that should be very, very thoroughly cleaned. Then you let it sit for 24 hours. Take out the plate, the glass plate at the bottom. That's going to be koshered separately. Wait 24 hours after cleaning the glass plate and pour hot scalding water on that plate, on every spot of that plate. You don't have to immerse it, but you do have to pour hot boiling water on every spot of that plate, directly from a kettle that has just this second been removed from the fire. That's how you kosher that plate. Then you put that plate back into the microwave. Take a microwave-compatible dish of water, turn on the microwave for about 10 minutes on high, and wait till you see that the microwave inner space, that all of the inside of it is full of steam, because that water is going to start to boil. And it fills with steam, hot, hot steam. Be careful when you open it afterwards, if you do open it soon after you do this, because the steam is very, very hot. And it koshers the microwave very thoroughly. As long as you've cleaned it well and thoroughly, this process koshers it very, very thoroughly. You should use a Pesach dish. Or throw away microwave compatible something.
And what about pouring the water on the glass plate?
Mm-hmm.
Pesach.
You should use a Pesach pot, pour the hot boiling water on that plate. That's l'chatchila what you would do.
But the Pesach pot has to be boiled on So your burner is already.
Your burner is koshering as you boil up that water. You're koshering your burner. You can take. If you want to do a tuf, if you want to kosher the burner using a pesachic pot with water on it, so that you kosher the burner and then use the hot water to kosher the microwave plate or anything else, that's just fine. Remember, the way to do your burners is going to be to turn them on, and if it's a gas burner, to turn it on with a pot of water on that burner to flatten the flame. Let's indeed start talking about gas and electric burners on the top of your stove, the stove top. The way to kosher them is to just turn them on for 15 minutes each, do them one at a time, because the amount of heat that they generate, otherwise if you have them all on at once, could be injurious to the safety of those around you. Could be injurious to you too, God forbid. You don't want to use that much heat all at once. Turn on all four burners on high for 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes. It's just too much. It's not good. Do
does
one or two at a time.
The
water does not have to boil. The only reason to put a pot of water on top of those gas burners is to spread the flame so it reaches all of the areas where it typically reaches when you cook chametz stick all year. With the electric, you just turn it on the highest setting. You don't have to put anything on because it all gets hot by itself. Use a Pesach pot or a chametz pot for that. Yeah, because you're not really using the pot to kosher anything. You're just using the pot of water to flatten the flame. And then underneath, you have to clean up that ring that you have underneath the burner. Clean it well and cover it. They have covers that you can buy in the store, all different sizes. Those little aluminum round covers. Cover that, which is underneath. If you can kosher that using hot boiling water without destroying the electric starter, well, fine, but I don't really advise it. I'm really worried that flooding of water is going to ruin that electric starter, and that's not a good idea. So you can just clean it really well and then cover it, and that's sufficient.
The book that I have on my stainless steel top says you can't use those throwaway foils.
Then you'll have to try just covering it with silver foil. You cut out your own silver foil, heavy-duty silver foil, press it down, and cover it. If you have a cooktop that's electric, but you don't see the coils are literally under the glass, so it's a glass cooktop, and the coils are under the glass, and you have cooking areas and circles where they tell you that's where you put your pot and that's where you cook, turn them on one or two at a time to the highest setting for 15, 20 minutes. That koshers that spot. However, the areas of that glass surface between those circles are not being koshered because they're just not going to get hot enough for us to say, well, you know, you've turned it on and fire burnt it out for 15, 20 minutes. They just don't get sufficiently hot. So use some trivets or other such metal grates. Put them down for the rest of the Pesach period. When you prepare for Pesach and cook before and when you're using your oven and stovetop on Pesach, those areas should be covered. If you can't cover it with silver foil because it's going to discolor, then just try to get some kind of metal grates that fit that middle area between the burners. That way, when you take a pot off a burner, you'll be able to put it down on one of these metal grates or trivets to avoid having a pot come from a burner and then rest on a spot of the top that's not been koshered. You don't want that. If it happens, I'm not convinced that it's going to cause the pot to become quote-unquote chametz stick. But it's subpar. It's not correct to let a Pesach stick pot rest on a surface that is hot, chametz stick, all year, and now has not yet been kosher because it really can't be. So you want to cover it with some metal grating or trivet. That's how we do our stovetops. Those are the basic three kinds. The glass covered, and then the classic gas range, or electric ring?
Not that I have one, but what do you do about an induction cooktop? It works on magnetism. It
right.
doesn't get hot and stuff. I'm just curious.
You would have to take a peseptic pot of water and run it on high for 20 minutes and make sure that the water starts to really boil and you know that it has the heat of the pot transferred up to the coil so that the coil is getting as hot or even hotter than it ever does during the year. Remember, there the coil gets hot because of the pot getting hot.
Right.
A little bit like a microwave oven gets hot and steamy because of the food in it, not that it itself generates heat, but it's secondary heat caused by the food. It's similar in the case of the induction.
I have a question. It's not really about the microwave. If you go away somewhere, can you kosher the microwave the same way?
100%, but you would have to wait 24 hours or know for sure that it hasn't been used for 24 hours. You can't really kosher a toaster oven. They're just too small, and they have too many nooks and crannies full of little crumbs that you're never really going to fully remove. So I advise that we get our toaster ovens put away, cleaned out, shake out the crumbs, blow out the crumbs, and then remove, you know, whatever you see as chametz be'ain, that you can actually look at. You know, if you look at it and say, oh my gosh, there's a crust of this or a spill of that, clean that up, and then put it away for Pesach. But don't kosher it. You really can't kosher a toaster or a toaster oven, okay? Now, the next area we have to talk about are countertops and sinks. I'm not a great proponent of using the steam method because those steam methods would require our aiming the nozzle on each and every spot of the countertop. If it's made of stone, you can only kosher stone. Caesar stone, not real stone, meaning granite or marble. And if you have granite or marble, you really should try to kosher it with hot boiling water, because using this steam kind of contraption means playing the nozzle with the hot steam for a very long time on each and every spot and moving it very, very slowly back and forth. Mm-hmm. You might have easily 30 square feet of countertop. I mean, easily. That's not even a lot. You know, 3 feet by 10 feet. It's 30 square feet of countertop. You might have much more than that. Milk, pleasure, power. So, using that kind of a steam cleaning method is going to be very tedious. Who's going to really sit there?
I do.
I have a small amount, and it takes me at least two hours to do it.
It takes a very, very long time.
Hot boiling water has ruined my cabinetry.
If your hot boiling water is going to ruin cabinetry, then you'll have to take that steam nozzle and play it on each and every spot for a good, 10 seconds, and then move. It's a very tedious, and it takes a long time. If you use hot boiling water, so the spout that you use, the pot that you use, can pour out a much wider, larger amount of water, and you can pour the water out in strokes that allow you to do a countertop of a few feet, let's say 5 feet, 6 feet by 3 feet, and maybe two strokes for every 4 or 5 feet, and let's say 4 or 5 inches wide, so you can kosher that maybe with 6-7 large quart pots full of water, and it's done. And now, it is important to cover the counters with towels. If you can, tuck towels over the drawers and over the doors of those cabinets underneath the stone so that they don't get wet, because the hot boiling water is, I'm sure, not good for the cabinetry. So that's how you might kosher that. And as I said, you really should not use this method for anything but real stone. The fact that it's been sealed with a sealer is not a concern. But the basic idea here is that that which is really naturally stone and that has not been mixed with resin of any other kind and that has not been fashioned by the human idea of what is or isn't penetrable, that's what Chazal knew can be kosher. Other items that today we create by crushing stone and mixing it with resins and glues and all of those fabricated kinds of tops are not really to be trusted as far as being kosherable. It should be treated less like we used to treat the old formica, which is not kosherable. Cover it. It's also not even hard to do, to cover with, you know, some nice, thick, clear plastic covers. And while it may not look as nice as the kitchen normally looks, but it's easily done and very, very functional. The only kinds of sink that you can kosher is stainless steel. Otherwise, use large tubs and keep your fleischig and your milchig dishes, you know, your fleischig in the red tub and your milchig in the blue or yellow tub, and use different tubs. If you have only one sink, then that's what you would do. If you have two sinks, you probably do the same thing, only you don't have to keep moving the tub in and out, because you have two sinks. If you have a stainless steel sink, on the other hand, well, then you take hot boiling water and first do the bottom of the sink. Remember, clean the sink, let it sit 24 hours, not used, dry. The sink should be unused and bone dry. And then slowly and carefully, gently pour hot boiling water across each spot of the bottom floor of the sink, sans the drain, meaning the plug of the drain. The drain also has to be kashered, but the plug should be kashered separately. Take the plug, or the stopper as it's called, out. You're going to take it apart. You're going to remove the rubber and the metal and separate them. You're going to clean that, throw it into some hot boiling water, kashering that stopper separately. After you do the bottom, splash water on all four sides of the sink. And it's kashered easily enough. Yes?
Years ago, if you at most, replace the washer.
I wouldn't replace the washer. I wouldn't replace the faucet or washer. At most, you take a hot pot of boiling water and pour it and splash upward to get the faucet, the top of it, the bottom of it.
That's it.
That's sufficient. No, you don't have to do anything more than that. You do not have to cover and line the shelves of your refrigerator. Just clean the refrigerator shelf really, 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 really well. That is sufficient.
Even if I put a hot pot in my fridge?
Even if you put hot pots down, if you clean it really well, that is sufficient. And you do have to cover other areas where we eat. That you must do. That's the minhag we have embraced. And if it is a table, the minhag is to cover it with two coverings. Kitchen table, dining room table. Now, the table pads that you use, those nice table pads that fit your dining room table perfectly, that does count as one. Even though it's there all year, it still counts as one cover. So if you have table pads, you can take a nice tablecloth and put it right down on top of your table pads, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. A plastic on top of a cloth, also, that constitutes two. Also, importantly, you don't need to have a Pesach dik tablecloth. If you have a beautiful tablecloth which you've used for chametz, just have it cleaned. And if it's something that you can clean at home, if it's something that's, you know, a no iron type thing, and you just clean it and use your own, you know, clothes washer to wash it, that's also fine. And don't worry about starch. If you take it to the cleaners and they starch it, don't worry about the starch, because they don't starch it so thick and so heavily that it's going to end up in your food. So you don't have to worry about, you know, whatever starch they might use at the cleaners to press and starch, you know, your linen. And that's why we don't have to worry about the starch that they use. We have basically covered most of the typical questions and issues of koshering and preparing. If you have questions, we'll take a few.
The countertops clean in 24-hour wait first also, like the sink?
Yes.
The paper towels, the plates, is there anything now?
No, you don't have to worry about the first and last sheet of the paper towels and having them touch your kalim. I wouldn't be concerned because it's not. Yeah, you can use them and let.
Food, you can put your food on the
so if you want, if it's going to come in contact with food directly, yeah. So then just in case there's a kidneyous starch that's sprayed on, then maybe for the first or last of the roll, avoid direct contact with food. But otherwise, it's not an issue.
And paper plates, plastic-coated plates, no problem.
No problem with them.
Warming drawer. If I take it apart and double wrap my food.
Fine. I don't know that you have to take it apart. You just have to clean it really, really well. Mm-hmm. A warming drawer can be cleaned really, really well. And then used by double wrapping any food that you want to put in it to warm up. I wouldn't put a torch to it because I don't think you can follow and see where the fire is going. And I'm worried that you're going to chas v'shalom.
I am not doing it yet.
Yeah. If a person can access all six sides, the roof, the floor, and all four walls with a torch, of course, then you can kosher it. Uh-huh. If it'll last and not get ruined, that's fine. But I would suspect that that's hard to do, and rather than go there, my suggestion is clean it really, really well and double wrap any food you want to put in and use it that way.
The thing you put into the sink, can that go directly on the sink, or does
yes.
it have to have a little...
But the outside of it is going to be touching the sink. Your dishes are not going to be touching the outside. They're only on the inside of the...
To the bottom is no problem.
Not a problem.
I have a question about going to a Sephardi family.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with this? Meaning that they're having rice and...
Not a problem. You just want to not consume anything that has...
But you can eat there.
You can eat there, yes. You just make sure that everything that is served to you contains no kidneys. And that it was clean, as opposed to a pot where they said, well, you know, we just finished the rice, and in the same pot, let's cook up some soup without cleaning it in between. That's all. You just want to make sure that it's a clean pot. Yeah.
Quinoa.
Quinoa is something we should treat as kidneyous unless there's somebody who really must have, you know, protein and can't ingest matzah and doesn't do well with potatoes and there's just nothing else to eat. So for such a person, we should certainly be makil and say that perhaps it's not to be treated as kidneyous. But Rabbi Belsky has felt for many, many years that it's very much a kidneyous type food. And while the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations has now apparently said that we may use it, Rav Belsky is known to have felt that it should not be used, and many others have said, you know, that unless you know for sure that something is so different from and so safe from accidental introduction of flour, barley, etc., it's not the kind of thing you want to get involved with. There was actually once a factory or producer of quinoa in Bolivia, where they admitted that they were using sacks to move the quinoa product, and those same sacks had been used for hummus. As an example, and now that's the classic kidneyous concern, that it's immediate midgin, it's piled and transferred and moved around in the same way that kidneyous is typically moved. So while technically those who gave us the idea of kidneyous didn't know about it, but if logically we understand that the concerns are there, so then we should perhaps be a little bit more careful. Again, if someone absolutely has to have it because there's something that they need and they can't have anything else,
But if the OU says it's okay, and we believe in the OU a whole year round...
I believe in the bonus law.
No, really. But we go by the OU all year round, so why wouldn't you go by the OU for pay stuff?
That's a personal decision that I can respect. But I personally feel that we can and should say, look, it's got all the... You know, as I once spoke to one of the decisors of Halacha, who leads the Kashrus department in the union, and I said to him, well, you know, it's a mead in the Midgan, yeah, okay, and it's farms where they make grain and grow grains, yeah, and you also can grind it up into flour and bake. So it's got all the, you know, it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, and he said, you're right. So now that causes me to say, look, if you can avoid it, so avoid it.
Urns, hot plates, and what about the Professor, can you use the same?
Urns have to be changed. You can't use your same urn for all year. And your hot plate has to be covered. It has to be covered with double the cover, and I really wonder if that's safe.
What, the hot plate or covering it?
Both. I really wonder.
Yeah, particularly after this one.
There's
a matzah that my husband and I saw. It's made with olive oil and rosemary. Is that egg matzah?
That's May Peros, and it should be avoided unless, that should be avoided. Again, for somebody who really needs that kind of matzah ashira, that's okay. Yeah.
What about a water cooler that cold?
I would use the cold and change the little plastic, if you can, on the spout for the side that's hot. Or not use it, one or the other. Instant hot also should be splashed with hot boiling water. And if there's a rubber nozzle, try to change it if you can. Otherwise, try to really cause... The cold side can be used.
What about like a NutriBullet, like a juicer that's only cold and it's only been fruits and vegetables?
Anything that's sitting on your counter all year is something you really don't want to use because it might have adulterated itself. It might have somehow gotten dirty. You know, you made a coffee, the decaffeination process is always, you know, chametz stick. You have all kinds of chametz on the counter. It's just subpar. The Keurig machine cannot be kashered for Pesach, by the way.
Brita pitcher?
That's fine. The Brita is fine. I would, again, get one for Pesach simply because while it's fine and there's no chametz that you put into it, but it's sitting on your, you know, chametz counter and your chametz table all year. Again, it's just subpar to have something like that on your table. Although, again, technically, it's used cold. It's not used hot, you know, but it's just subpar. We don't want things that could have had some chametz attached to it. You don't want to have that on your table on Pesach. And
canister has tea in it, let's say. Lipton tea. The only thing it has is Lipton tea. Can you keep that same canister?
You can keep the canister on your counter because you're not using it to actually dispense food directly onto your plate.
I go to someone's house and the rabbi told them that they can use the same room as long as they just run it through once. And I make your own, I'm not allowed to.
I wouldn't. Not because it's not kosher, but because it's Pesach. They're not exactly the same. And you can run it through once, but the outside of it is never going to get properly kashered because it's hard rubber, and unless you've taken it and immersed it in hot boiling water. So again, are you going to be consuming actual chametz? No, but it's subpar because it's not been kashered. Thank you very much. And I turn the halacha portion of this evening over to Rabbi Trump.
Thank you, ladies, Bereshis and Rav. I thank Rav Talavan for this opportunity to learn with you. We're going to be focusing just in the next few minutes on the Seder itself. So once we've got there, now enjoying or preparing enough that this should be a Seder which fits. I was just thinking about this in terms of, you know, there's a lot of different measurements and there's a lot of different time issues, but it's important that we get this all straight because it's lahavdil. If you imagine, you know, let's say, you know, some expensive computer program says, you know, Adobe says they give you a 1-hour free download of one of their programs. You know, their programs are worth hundreds of dollars. They say you can download it, you just need to bring the right, you know, the right attachment, you need to bring the right cord to download it. And you say, well, HDMI, USB, VGA, it's all right, I'll bring whatever I have. And at the end of the day, the answer is, well, it doesn't work. If you don't have the right cable, it's not working. We have an opportunity. So it's important that we get the cable right. We have the right way, that we have the, we're in the right timing. We can connect to the electricity, so we're getting the right program download at the time that we have it. So in that regard, it is important that the Seder begins after Tzeis, after the stars are out, which means, as we pass in 15 minutes after Shkia, which this Friday night in 2 weeks' time will be at 8:03 in the evening. So that is going to be upcoming. But starting Seder means does not mean to say as you dance around and you sing Kaddish Ruchatz and you do another round. Starting means to say Kiddush. That's when the actual Seder begins. So that's the point where one is expected to begin. And the Shulchan Aruch goes so far as to say, as much as is possible, it's a good idea, therefore, to make sure the table's set before Yom Tov, because that means it's going to allow you, so that whenever anybody's coming home from Shul, that at that point in time, you can get the earlier start, because then you can get the most out of the evening. You're able to get as much in as early as possible. We also, therefore, the outer guideline of it is we try to finish the Afikoman, that means to say finishing that entire Kazayas Afikoman, before Chatzos, before midnight. Now, midnight is not measured with the clock striking 12, but rather the hours of the night divided from night to morning by 12, which this year, that Friday night, will give us 12:57. So that's ample time to have a Seder to be finished, certainly the Afikoman at least, by 12:57 a.m. The reason why this is so important is because that night of the Seder, as an argument between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Azariah, when we eat the Korban Pesach until, and one Rabbi Elazar and Azariah says until midnight, because midnight was the real nace when Mitzrayim was all in their commotion, as Rabbi Akiva says in the morning, that was the point in time in which Israel was actually walking out. So that's a debate as well, whom we follow. A number of the Rishonim say we should follow Rabbi Elazar and Azariah, that's midnight, which is why not only the Korban Pesach follows that pattern, but the Matzah and the Kiddush leading up to it. That's why the time frame is set as such. That, by the way, also gives us a little bit of an understanding to that paragraph of those five Rabbanim in Bnei Brak. That's a little bit of the background of that. So that's in terms of the timing itself. We have a very special mitzvah, which is a mitzvah of Midah Raisa, of eating Matzah on the night of the Seder. You'll see some of the Haggadahs have Moitzi Matzah, right? They sometimes divide it up differently. In fact, Shulchan Aruch talks about the necessity to have a little bit of both. So what that means to say is that we're going to be having a kazayis of matzah, when we try to have that the Baal HaSeder passes out a little bit of each of both. But the main point is that by eating that kazayis, you are fulfilling both the mitzvah of moitzi, regular moitzi for the evening, as if you would be on a Yom Tov, and matzah, which is the mitzvah of the evening. That matzah we eat a kazayas of, and the shear of a kazayas, which we use, is around about half a handmade matzah. Not about half a handmade matzah, about three quarters of a machine-made matzah for the evening. Just one second. The reason why that is such is that a kazayas literally means, obviously, as we know, a olive. Now, if you look at our olives, our olive is a little smaller than that, but it is understood by many, many poskim that the shear of the olive that was talked about in the times of the Gemara was a larger size, which is around about a small egg in what we're talking about, which lends to the volume that we're talking about in terms of that shear of matzah. This is the only time during Pesach that there's actually an obligation to eat matzah. The rest of the Pesach, you could, technically, if you could survive on potatoes, you would be fine. There's a mitzvah to go ahead and try as much as you can, but the night of Pesach one has to have that specific kazayis. It's also important to keep it within a certain time frame, which is called kedei achiras pras, the amount that it takes to eat a pras, which we should try on the more machmir side. The best to get it is within 4 minutes, and this doesn't mean to say that a person needs to be stuffing oneself, because halacha isn't requiring a person to do something superhuman. It's something which is a normal, but if you're to eat normally and not interrupt, and you eat your half a matzah within that period of time, you're going to get through it within 4 minutes. The point is, don't distract yourself, especially for this kazayis, while doing this, so you're able to consume it within this amount of time. For people who have trouble, people who have perhaps eating issues, there might be a, one is able to have a little bit, 4 to 6 minutes, perhaps a longer element, 9, but again, that's depending on the level of need that a person may have medically. Similarly with maror. Maror also requires a kazayis, so you do that immediately afterwards in the Seder. And the shear is really the volume of about 1.4 ounces of the volume of maror, which I understand to be, if you were to put that maror into a shot glass, or half, 1.5 shot glasses, you could stuff it in, that would give you the amount. Now, and I was discussing this with our Talbam, the point over here is not to be sitting at the Seder with rulers, and not to be sitting there killing yourself trying to work out all these things. It needs to be the kind of thing that we think about a little bit beforehand, so we make sure we're doing it right, but when we're doing it, we're doing it. We're living it. We're experiencing it. So you're taking out the matzahs, you're not sitting there with the ruler, you're handing out the matzahs, we're doing it well enough, and if you can do more, great. Make sure you're well covered. But the point is that that we should get a sense of what this is, and certainly be approximating on the upper edge of that in order to be able to fulfill this mitzvah properly. When it comes to the 4 cups of wine, this is a positive mitzvah, which is time-bound. It is the first night of Pesach. So that means to say that most of the people in this room, therefore, would be exempt. But that's not true. The reason is it's not true is because it is what's called afheno yubas anes, meaning the ladies are part of the miracle as well. Now that has two meanings, just interestingly enough. On the one hand, that means to say that women were primary beneficiaries like men of the salvation, but also is that they also facilitated the miracle. So therefore, there's the women who had the hope to continue the salvation, and similarly also people like Miriam who had the hope and the vision of being able to get out of Mitzrayim. And therefore, women are also obligated in the 4 cups of wine. The 4 cups of wine are spotted specifically throughout the Seder, and it's important they're distinct from one another. It is important that a person has a revius, or a certain measurement of wine. And the Shulchan Aruch says a person should have a cup or a roiv of a cup, most of a cup. What makes most sense, therefore, is to try to get a cup which is just over the share of a revius. Because let's say you get, a beer tankard, some people, one person once said, the doctor said, I'm only allowed to have 1 cup a day. So he goes out and gets, this gallon. That if you're going to do that, there's an opinion in Shulchan Aruch which says you need to have the roiv of that cup. So don't go to town in terms of getting a beer tankard, but if you the very, very bare minimum to have is going to be 3.4 liquid ounces, and certainly for the first cup, it is better to try to push to 4.2 ounces for the first one, which is also Kiddush itself. If you have something, what was that? This year, specifically because it's Shabbos. So in that case, if you're going to have something around 4 ounces, and that's going to be the 4 liquid ounces, then you're going to be safe all the time around, because you'll have a roiv of that, you'll have a majority of that, that's a full cheekful of that, and you're going to be sufficiently covered. And you don't have to worry about, you don't have to think about it afterwards, because a little bit of preparation helps us with that. I actually did this, I just wanted to show you. I measured it out. It's not a horrendous looking thing. I measured out the things. These are cups which need good polishing. But just about the bottom of the line is about 3.4 ounces, and about 4.2 is just the top of the line. So if you're getting a regular becher, and you fill it up, something of this size, you're good. It's around this, maybe a touch smaller, but this is really in a good size. If you turn into that, it's about, for 3.4 ounces, we're talking about just over 100 milliliters, and 125 milliliters for 4.2. So you're safe. Something looking like this is just to give a sense of it. It's always worthwhile doing the measurements before the Seder rather than arriving. So Rav Kost would be to say that you take it down to at least well over half. Right? That'd be a which is, you know, about, practically speaking, about 2 gulps, you know. Meaning it's not, you know, it's, you know.
So you don't have to drink all the 4.2, you just have to drink most of it?
That's correct. Correct. Exactly.
So we go for most or half? Which one is it? Is it most or just a little more than half?
How would we say? Just 51%, I would say.
Rough cost means?
Of course.
51%?
Yeah, 51%.
Look, if you can finish. So, if you can't, look, best thing is to drink full cost of the whole thing. But if you can manage it, by all means. But that's a lot of wine.
Does it have to be apple?
Well, that's Robbie Trump's going to be discussing.
So, yeah, so in terms of the content of what's going to actually be in that cup that we're drinking, there is an importance of having wine, and in fact that is to the exclusion of grape juice, that it is important to be having wine, and unless there's a situation medically requiring it that a person isn't able to and they would need to require some mixing, one should endeavor to have wine as part of this. And interestingly enough, the Shulchan Aruch says it's important that that should be red wine, actually, unless there is a fantastic... What was that? This is for all the cups. This is all the 4 cups. Why red specifically? So one of the memories that it's supposed to conjure up is the memory of the blood. That's a double-edged memory. It's the blood of... Unfortunately, blood is a good and a bad part of it. One, the good part of it is the blood of the Makkah of Dam. But on the other hand, there was also the blood of our infants that we remember as well. So there's a double-edged sword over there, which is important and is supposed to... We are experiencing that as we drink that wine when we're thinking about that. In terms of the charoses is one of the few things that the Gemara actually talks about the recipe of something. And the Gemara says that according to the opinion that there's a mitzvah to have charoses, which generally is our practice, one of the reasons is in order to remember the cement. That's what we're taught in day school. But there's also another element to it, and the Gemara says that's because one should have it, there should be apple in it, because it reminds us of the apple trees in which the Nashim Sid Konyas would bring back hope to their husbands, to procreate, to bring the nation to its full redemption. So there's an element, again, of the hope and the despair caught within it, which is why, interestingly enough, Shulchan Aruch says, it talks about the consistency being that of cement, but also talks about the apple, and adds in a little bit that there should perhaps also be wine in it as well. Wine, again, Tosis adds in, is again that element of blood. So there's a lot of experiences that we're experiencing through the actual item itself. Just to leave off.
So can we eat a lot of chalosah? In my family, really, they don't let us eat a lot of chalosah.
So the Shulchan Aruch actually says that the way it's supposed to do it is one's supposed to dip the maror in, submerge it even, but then shake it off. Because you're not supposed to, you don't want to be interfering with the experience of the maror. Now, at the same time, you're welcome to have as much charoses as you want in the meal.
Okay.
But the point is, it shouldn't interfere with the experience of Mara. I know that everybody's very excited about that point of the Seder.
I don't prepare.
And it shouldn't be taken for granted, the beauty of the charoses, but it shouldn't interfere with the Mara, and it's definitely available
but
for
we could
the meal itself.
Okay.
No, there's no question about that at all. Yes.
Isn't it interesting that you're saying that using the apples because the women would bring the apples to the men to help procreate, seduce, and then we have with Adam and Chava that she...
But
yes,
it's not an apple there.
It is interesting. There is a connection, obviously, back to Ria with Megan and Mikedem. I think, in fact, our Taliban spoke about this just... This was our Taliban talked about this just very recently. Rosh Hashanah, about the charesis and the connection. There's a lot of beautiful background to that. But it's interesting that the Shulchan Aruch actually goes out of its way to talk about the ingredients. One last point just to finish up. The Shulchan Aruch goes so far as to say... The Shulchan Aruch goes so far as to say, and I'd like to just quote it in a sentence, is mitzvah l'chalek v'tinoikos kloyos v'egozim. One should hand out nuts and or different types of nuts to the children in order that they should ask about the change. And then obviously in those days, we're not talking about nut allergy kids, unfortunately, but nuts means to say, in the way the Rambam describes it, is something that they like. So in our day, it would be the equivalent to be a candy. But the point is that there's an importance, and there's not to say it's not just to be a cerebral experience, there should be an experiential experience as well, that our children are engaged in, our children, our grandkids, are very much a part. And this is a important part of it, so that as much as we're doing all this preparation and we're making sure that we're connecting and we've got the right cord to make sure that this time is really going to generate the maximum amount of what's really there for us, or we're able to connect to. At the same time, we should remember that the kids are also part of that, and that's a halacha as well as part of the Sfarim.
Because I'm a bit klutzy. What's the halacha of sold water on Shabbos versus on Yom Kippur?
To prepare it.
You're supposed to make it beforehand, correct?
Right.
Okay. But I have in the past have had, luckily I have made, but sometimes I'm just worried. If you spill it all, you can't make it on Shabbos at all, correct?
It comes on the same issue with charos as well, but just to double check. If there's no salt water, if there's no salt water left, so how do we? They're making salt water.
You would have to mix it. You could make it on Shabbos if you have to.
And on Yom Tov then also.
On Yom Tov, it's not a problem.
If you have to.
That's to avoid one of the issues.
It's just a mixture of that you can prepare for beforehand. So you should try to prepare it beforehand.
No, she said if she still...
So then you'll take... Remember, there's no sheer...
Extra jars.
Yeah, there's no sheer of how salty it needs to be. So because we're not dealing with preparing a brine that's going to cure anything, you know, we're not preparing a brine that's so strong, you're just mixing some salt with some water, it's fine.
So once again, I thank you for the opportunity, and I think we'll close this.
Yeah, it's up to you. Well, and then we can wait a few minutes. We'll,
I think so. Yeah,
four minutes.
This is the framework, and now if for those who are able to stay, we're going to start the next section
in about four or five minutes
as people filter in to now the talk about Maggid, which is now the putting the flesh into that framework. Thank you very much, ladies.
Thank you.
So even if people get inebriated from four cups of wine, they're still obligated to drink it.
So great for us to let them. Just don't let them serve your port.
That's great that you brought it. That's a great stop. That's a great visual. Woo! So that's bigger, right?
This would be, so the bottom line would be 3.4, and around the year 3.4 is about
4.4. This is a significant becher.
That's
a significant becher. It's beautiful, but it's not huge. Yeah, because this year it's good. Right, this was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.